Deezer Originals.
This is Defending in Numbers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time you're listening, this is Defending in Numbers, the football podcast where we walk down the corridor of uncertainty, pretending to know a little bit more about the beautiful game than we actually do. My name is Rob Armstrong, the token football idiot, the football idiot of Defending in Numbers. I sit here every week and get corrected on my ignorance by football geniuses like Ali Maxwell. Ali, how are you?
Yes, I'm very well. Thanks, Rob. Very generous introduction there.
The Football League genius, should I say? Or yeah. You're just an all-round football genius?
I'll take that.
If you could choose to be one kind of football genius, what would it be?
Probably wouldn't be the Football League genius, although it's a nice niche and one that I enjoy. I'd probably just be a skills genius. I'd love to be making those YouTube videos where I'm just doing panenkas and getting millions of pounds from brands.
And of course, we're joined by goalkeeping hat and facial hair genius, David Priest.
Good morning. How are you doing, David? I'm very well, thank you very much.
Excellent. Right. This, of course, is Defending in Numbers, and you are listening on Deezer, where you can also find lots more great podcasts, live Premier League commentary and football playlists. Download the app, that's Deezer, in your relative app store, or go to www.deezer.com. Let's get on with the first feature, Week by Numbers.
The Week by Numbers.
Okay, the first number this week is number one, which is, of course, the first number in just everything, generally, numerically, is the first number. And that is also the amount of FA Cup third round ties Arsene Wenger has lost. Nottingham Forest, of course, beating them 4-2 in what was, I think, fair to say, a pretty shambolic performance from Arsenal, but at the same time, a very good performance from Nottingham Forest. That Forest team, only 14th in the Championship, but looks like it has a lot of young talent in it.
Yeah, and like a lot of young talent, that's part of the problem with their league position, a lack of consistency, perhaps a lack of game management, and in the Championship where you play so many games, you know, a difficulty in maintaining form, which is completely natural, I think, for young players and often going to be the case. And you know, it's I think, surprising, having seen the performance on the weekend, that, you know, they recently sacked their manager because they weren't happy with the way that they were doing, and then they turn in a performance for the ages. But I mean, the most surprising thing for me with this number is that it's the first time that Arsene Wenger's lost in the third round. I'm surprised it's taken this long, to be honest, because, you know, performances like that, it's not the first time we've seen something like that from Arsenal. So I'm surprised it's the first loss in the third round.
Yeah, it's funny. But we'll talk about Arsenal in a minute, but let's first talk about Forest. Give it credit where it's due, because they were comfortably the better team. You know, I watched the whole game, and at no point did I think Forest are going to throw this away. The minute they were ahead, I thought they had it covered. And it was a bit of a frantic game. You know, maybe could have done with having VAR, which we'll talk about later as well, in that one rather than the day after. But yeah, what do you see in that Forest side in terms of potential?
Well, like Ali's just said about youngsters, playing a lot of youngsters in size, sometimes you don't know what you're going to get and what you expect from them. Are they going to be nervous, or are they going to go into no fear? And you can see from the way Forest approach it, like they had no fear whatsoever. And it's not like, look at that Arsenal side. This isn't a greatly weak, I mean, it's a weakened side from what they usually put in the Premier League, but it's not hugely inexperienced. There's probably three players out of that side who you would think, well, you know, they wouldn't ordinarily get into a Premier League starting 11. So it's massive credit to Forest, and it's great to see that, because that's what clubs like Forest, you know, they haven't got the riches that some of the clubs have got in that division. They're certainly not a poor club, but they've. It's great to see them investing in youth, because really clubs in that, especially in that division, who are middling or at the bottom end of that division, they've got to produce their own players, and clubs have went away for that for far too long. And even sometimes it's just paying lip service to youth systems and academies by investing lots of money in them, but not truly believing in them, where Forest are clearly different from a lot of clubs.
And it showed exactly how high their ceiling is. You know, we said that they can be inconsistent and that sometimes the game management is off. But when it's on, that's when you learn how high a player's ceiling is. And those guys, Cash, Brereton and Worrell, you know, they've just done it against supposedly one of the best sides in England. So clearly massive futures for those players and hopefully with that club.
With the Arsenal thing, obviously for the last few years, winning the FA Cup hasn't been enough. What do you think of the sort of outrage and disgust that they've gone out of the third round? Because, you know, you listen to a lot of Arsenal fans and they say, oh, Wenger out, FA Cup, don't care. Now all of a sudden, some of them are more vocal.
Well, I know some people say this have kind of, Arsenal fans were upset that they didn't have a stronger bench, sort of a few players in glass cages just to smash in case of emergency. But like I said, they didn't really have a hugely inexperienced side. Look at all the players in that side and the Premier League appearances that they've all made. It's and another good thing about this from what we've seen in the Premier League so far, when there's been a huge disparity between teams, especially when people play Manchester City, the way they've set up defensively against those sides, it's been actually really refreshing that the likes of Forest and Bristol City haven't done that. And Bristol City didn't come up with a result last night, but they come up with a huge deal of credit. Maybe they haven't gone toe-to-toe, but they've certainly had much more of a goal than a lot of the Premier League sides this season.
I think one of the big things for me when it comes to the outrage from Arsenal fans, I'm surprised that they can muster up the energy for it because, you know, it's been going on for quite a few years now. There was, in the early days of the Wenger out regime, I definitely thought that, you know, people were being a bit harsh and maybe not recognising the amazing impact that Wenger's had on that club. But I think when you get to this stage, I don't think there's anyone that can really strongly say that he absolutely deserves to stay. And you know, it stems from just tiredness of Arsenal being embarrassed. And that's what we've seen over the last few years, countless times in the league, in certain cup competitions, sort of in the Champions League as well at times, where they've suffered heavy defeats in the knockout stages. It's a sort of fatigue of this, why is it always us, seemingly, because that's how you feel as a fan, right? It's always your team that loses in the last minute or your team that folds when they go behind, and that's how Arsenal fans feel, probably more heightened than any other club in England, I suppose.
Imagine what a lovely retirement Arsene Wenger could have. He could have a house in England, house in France.
Maybe one in Japan.
Yeah, exactly. Was it Gamba Osaka was he at?
Can't remember. Yeah, I think so.
Pulled just some random Japanese club out of nowhere. Let's move on to the next number, 0. Not just my knowledge of Japanese clubs, but also the number of VAR decisions there were in the Brighton Crystal Palace game the other night. Like we were saying, maybe they should have had it for the Forest game. But I was at the Brighton game and the Palace fans were incensed that VAR wasn't used for the Glenn Murray goal at the end, the winner for Brighton. Was it handball?
Well, I'm a bit confused about this because I think it was used to check the goal because it always is. But I think the first thing they check is the offside. And I think that because that was the first game, there was so much of a spotlight on it. You could tell that the broadcasters had been told to reference it at all times as well, because they're clearly trying to make it a part of the game and they're trying to push that through as quickly as possible so that we can stop talking about it all the time. With the Murray goal, it's hard to say because there was definitely sort of rumours that they didn't check it for handball and that they were only checking it for offside. Now, I kind of get the feeling that if it had clearly hit his hand, someone surely would have seen that. Like, it seems unlikely. But certainly the inference was that they didn't use it for that, which seems bizarre. But it wasn't handball anyway, so doesn't matter.
Well, I don't think it's going to have as much of a difference as goal line technology has. I mean, obviously, that's a lot clearer. It's black and white if it's either over the line or it isn't. But with these cases, just there's going to be... for someone like me who enjoys the errors that referees make, even as a player, you take things on the chin, you get away with a few, you get done by a few. So it all adds to the drama of the game. But I still don't think that's going to be taken away from us, because there's still going to be a lot of debate about decisions that are made that referees and the video assistant referees are going to have some sort of they're not always going to agree, because it's a lot of it's the decisions that are going to be made. It's still open to interpretation.
Yeah, people are swinging back and forth, and I know there's a lot of people that have been constantly in support of it, and now that it's come through, and still people don't really know how it works. My understanding of it was there's a screen at the side of the pitch that he runs over to and looks at the decision again, but then it's actually there's some referees somewhere in. Where is it? Something Park or Stockbridge
Near
Park?
Heathrow, yeah.
Wherever it is. Yeah. There's some referees in the room looking at the decision and making the decision for them. So there's no clarity on it. And it also, you look at Serie A, I think there's been a few dodgy decisions there. And maybe, I mean, I've just seen in some tweets when I've been reading about it that there's the Australian A-League, they keep messing up over there.
Like with everything, when it goes wrong, you're going to hear about it louder than when it goes right. I think that, you know, It's not going to lead to more errors being made by referees. It's only going to take away some of them. So, like David says, and I think this is a big point, because you said people are flip-flopping back and forth, and they are. You basically have to decide now whether you like the flow of the game, whether you like the passion of the game, which is what so many of us are attracted to when it comes to football. Other people are attracted to fairness, competition, tactics, analytics, whatever. But if your desire is for bad decisions against your team to be starting to be quashed, then you've got to be in favour of it, really, and you can't really sit on the fence there. I think you either want the passion and the flow of the game and the mistakes and the excitement, or you want it to be perfect, you know, sterile and correct.
Just like everything else, though, I think it's just going to take time, and referees are going to get used to the types of decisions that incidents that are going to be flagged up, and also it's even in a game, you know, they make decisions very quickly, sometimes off very little evidence. They can't, you know, don't have great views, and they make their decisions on their experience as well. But even now, it's strange for them to going over to the side of the screen, and it's all new to them. So even though they're used to working under pressure situations, they've still got to run over there. It's still alien to them, and they've still got to make this rush decision and take everything in a few seconds. I mean, it can take up to 3 minutes, I think, for debatable decisions. Mm. Average 30 to 40 seconds. So I'm not too concerned about upsetting the ebb and flow of games or becoming a hindrance, but it just makes sure that the more they do it, the better they're going to get it, and the less of a hindrance in the game it's going to be.
The last thing is that the referee still has the final decision, so there's potential for them to go over because they've been told to check something, see that they might have made a mistake, but stick with their decision. So I think we're all looking forward to Mike Dean doing that in the coming months.
Yeah, spending an extra long time with his head in that monitor thing. Oh, wow, I look great. Ooh, what a straight arm that is, given that decision. Let's move on to the next number. Number 84, and that's the number of chances created in the Premier League by Ross Barkley since the end of last season, which is still more than any other Everton player at the moment. Obviously, he's transferred to Chelsea this week, hasn't even played this year, and is still on top in terms of the chances created since last season of the squad. Seems like a bit of an odd one for Chelsea, because I don't see that position, that sort of number 10 attacking midfielder, I don't see that as the hole they need to fill necessarily, which makes me think, because Ross Barkley's a big lad, are they going to turn him into a striker, maybe?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I see him
pure speculation for me.
Yeah. It's quite hard to really know what Ross Barkley's true position is and where he thinks he plays, because his career has been so disrupted by injuries, and because you know, he has been tried out in different areas. How I see it happening is him in the centre of midfield. Now, last season it was a sort of 3-4-3, but this season Conte's really preferred, and especially in big games and in Europe, a 3-5-2. Some Chelsea fans have been a bit upset about, because it's taken away one of those purely attacking players, normally Pedro or Willian, sacrificed for another central midfield player. And a lot of the frustration from fans has come from Bakayoko's performances as he grows into himself as a player, perhaps not being that great. But for me, Barkley fits quite well into that midfield three. If you can have an N'Golo Kanté, a Cesc Fabregas and a Barkley, for me, you've got most of your boxes ticked there. You've got a ball winner, a passer, and someone who can drive through the middle. That's what Barkley offers. I think that people fetishise so much. Someone like Jack Wilshere as well, who can drive through the middle, get at teams through the centre, which is a great skill. And if he can get fit, I think it's a great signing. 50 million quid.
Yeah.
Sounds ridiculous to say. It's not that much these days.
You have to think it's only going to go up, isn't it? So even if they sell, it's probably a profit. But is that, you said there, Fabregas, Barkley and Kante, is that maybe putting too much the stress on Kante to do the defending? Because I think it's a fairly well-known criticism of Fabregas that maybe he doesn't offer you enough going back. And then Barkley probably also has been guilty of being maybe a little bit of a sort of luxury role at times.
Yeah, I think it's fair. I do think that Kante can pretty much do all of the defensive work on his own, and his performance levels are still incredibly high, although he's become less of a novelty, but he's still playing brilliantly. What I've seen is that when he does play with someone equally defensive-minded, his passing's not quite good enough to support a team that needs to be comfortable in possession, that needs to be circulating the ball around. So I actually think it's not going to be such a big problem. But I'd be interested to know what David thinks.
No, but even if they do play a 3-5-2, then it becomes less of a need for either Fabregas or Bartley to defend. Right, he's not the great defensively. He gets dispossessed of the ball quite a lot, so he probably needs to have somebody like Conte working alongside him to mop up some of those mistakes. I mean, for them to buy him for 15 million, it's like you looked at a lovely pair of trainers last summer and you thought you couldn't afford them, then they were on a half price now, so you thought, well, I'm going to buy them anyway. I don't need them, but I'm going to buy them anyway. Plus, he's English as well, so it helps with the quotas. And there's this thing about potential in players, and he's 24 now, Barkley, and you get to a point where you go away from that. You become less of the. I mean, even like, I know injuries played a part in Jack Wilshere as well, and we keep saying they've not fulfilled the potential that they had. It's about time they started doing that, and the only way to do that is by keeping fit. You worry about the type of injury that he's had. I mean, he's got a huge scar down the back of his hamstring, and it's always a delicate area to look after. So if he can keep fit, then he can be an asset. But I can't see him, in all honesty, I can't see him being a sort of like a fulcrum of that side or a mainstay. He's going to be taking on the same role as kind of Willian's taken on of late, where he's brilliant at what he does, and when he comes in, when he's needed, he comes in and does well, and he's got to make sure that he's ready to play that role.
Where would you have focused on before Barkley for Chelsea? Because I think a lot of the talk is up front, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Morata cover. Because Batshuayi sometimes looks good, but then in terms of coming off the bench, not so much.
It's probably this time last year that
Starting is bad. Yeah. Coming off the bench is all right. Yeah. Starting, rubbish.
Well, that's it. It's probably this time last year when he started playing a few of the FA Cup games and scoring a few goals for himself and managed to grab a couple of goals. Important goals towards the end of the season as they won the league, and you thought he turned the corner a little bit, but Conte, he's obviously not a huge fan of his, and it's true. It's a club like Chelsea, for the ambitions they've got and where they want to be, they're just far too lightweight up front, and they're reliant. You can see it weighs heavily sometimes on Morata. He's had a great start, but when he has a game like he did there the other week and he's missing chances, there's no way of relieving him of that, really, without weakening the side.
Is there a case as well that Chelsea, with their up front, that their striking options, they need a sort of plan B? Because Morata, he is brilliant with his feet before he shoots. You know, his touch in and his link up play, brilliant. Then he's maybe not been the best when it comes to finishing with his feet.
But the big game experience he's got is brilliant, and he scores goals in those big games. But this is probably his first real season as a first choice number one striker. And people have mentioned before that, not taking those chances that he did the other, who was it against?
Arsenal.
Yeah. So he doesn't take those chances. And is it a case of fatigue setting in? And maybe not physically, but when there's a lot of pressure on you, and you get it. In the past, he's had time to recover in between big games, and he's been used sparingly, and probably now that he's going to have that little dip which he's having now.
Ali, what do you think about Chelsea being linked with Big AC, the big dog, Carroll?
I think that would be ridiculous.
Never for like 30 million, 35 million if you want him?
No, I don't see that really being a feasible option. Chelsea's recruitment in the last few years has been interesting. Someone tweeted a list of their signings, the last sort of 30 signings, and a lot of them, you know, it got retweeted a lot because it looks a bit rubbish, to be honest. A lot of the players, you know, that you forget quickly, like Baba Rahman and people like that, that just sort of fade
household
from
names.
View.
Mm-hmm.
Well, exactly. But because they don't make as much revenue as Man United or Man City off the pitch, because of the size of the stadium and a couple of other factors, because of FFP, they aren't actually spending. They're not rivaling clubs for the signings of Pogba or Coutinho or Neymar. They can't do that. They've taken a slightly different tack. So that involves not buying the finished product, world-class players, but trying to find the ones at the level below that they can develop, and crucially for Chelsea, retaining some sort of sell-on value. That's where Andy Carroll, amongst a number of other reasons, really falls down, because he's not exactly an asset that's going to make you money in the future.
Really? Oh, I thought we were going to make profit on that 15 million for those four games a year. You get let's move on to the next number, which is 400 million. And that's the amount of euros that Philip Coutinho has as his release clause at Barcelona. Obviously signed for them for 160 million euros this week. Coutinho very much in his prime, I think. And the best time for him to go. He spent 5 years at Liverpool. And I'm not sure fully how much animosity they have towards him, because he's been brilliant for the first 6 months. Well, he was obviously injured for a little bit, but for what he's played of him for them this season, he has been brilliant and has very much earned his move. But how good of a move is it for Barcelona? Ali, you're wearing a sort of Barcelona-y shirt, Barcelona or Palace-y shirt.
Yeah.
How good do you think he'll be for them, and where does he fit in that system? Because they've been waiting for him. Because obviously they've got Dembele as well, but they've been waiting for Coutinho since they got rid of Neymar.
Well, they've basically been playing 4-4-2 this season, either with a sort of fairly packed central midfield diamond, or with, you know, Iniesta coming in from the wing. That's obviously Dembele's injuries affected how they play. With Dembele back and Coutinho, you know, these are. Versatile, modern attacking players, and that gives you a lot of different options now. The team will always and has to be based around Leo Messi. So, you know, where they play will depend a lot on Leo and where he wants them to play. But we've seen Coutinho play as part of the front three at Liverpool out on the left. We've seen him play increasingly this season against teams defending in a low block, which is what Barcelona come up against a lot, as one of the midfield three in the 4-3-3 and attacking from a bit deeper. So he's clearly someone who gives them more options. He's a player, as you say, in his prime, whose performance level when he's played this season has been very, very good. And yeah, I think there did seem to be a bit of panic, as there always is on Twitter. And, you know, you can get a bit distracted through Twitter because people are idiots. But there was, I think, a bit of panic. But generally, you're right. I don't think huge amount of animosity. And it doesn't leave them in as much trouble, Liverpool, I mean, as it did when Suarez left.
Well, that's what I was going to say, David. Obviously, I've got a couple of Liverpool supporting mates who have said things like, "Car, the fourth best team in the Premier League selling their third best player for 160 million. Oh, I'll take that any day." Is he their third best player, or is he a class above Liverpool? Because obviously Salah has been brilliant this season particularly, and Mane last season was sort of irreplaceable at times. When he went away for African Cup of Nations, they struggled. Coutinho, they've played parts of this season without him and seem to look okay.
Yeah, they've managed without him. And I think that, like you said about last year, about Mane, and well, there's 10, 11 games went without a win last season. They haven't had as much trouble this season without Coutinho. And yeah, any squad and any side is going to be weakened by his departure. But after what happened in the summer and the saga, and it was always going to be difficult for them to keep hold of him. And When it happens once to a player and you convince him to stay with a promise that he'd be allowed to move at a later date, unless it's set in stone that it'd be next season, it was always going to be different to keep him. And when Barcelona came back in for him, there was no way they were going to keep all of them. no way at all. And you can keep somebody happy for so long. And I think once somebody's got their mind made up, great attitude, you've got to give him a lot of credit for just getting on with things and letting his performance levels drop. But I think from my experience with players, you know, once they've made their mind up, then you've got to let them go. And the fee they've got from them, it's great business all around, I think.
In your playing days, did you ever have the situation where one of your teammates knew they were getting a move in 6 months' time or wanted a move and then had to put it off and then you had to play with them? Like, what effect did that have on the team?
You can see in a lot of cases it's all down to each individual's personality and character. And I think that's where managers earn their money, because they've got to assess that and they've got to weigh up the pros and the cons. I think it would be easy for players, especially if they're not the most popular. Now, I get the impression that Coutinho was very popular. So even if his performance levels did drop, or he didn't look like he was in the game, people wouldn't be pointing their fingers as much. And I think when sometimes you get unpopular, then it's easy for somebody, if they have a bad game, they might just be having a bad game, but because of all the speculation and everyone knows that they want to get away, then you can come back to the dressing room straight away and you can point their fingers and there's nothing you can do about it, really, because, I mean, it's okay when if somebody comes in for you like that and you know it's inevitable, whether it happens at the start of January or the end of January, it's inevitable. But it's not a conscious thing. You know, you might give 100%, but at the back of your mind, there's something there that knows you're going to wait a later date. So you're not fully committed and you're not totally there and there as much as you are. So I think it's, like I said, it's down to the manager to assess what the situation is and whether it's going to work out for the club or not. Mm. But from my experiences now, knowing what I know, as soon as a player either asks to leave or doesn't make it 100% clear that he wants to stay, it's best just to set them free. Mm.
Like serving your notice period in any job.
Yeah, definitely. We definitely, as fans, tend to treat footballers a bit differently to how we would treat anyone else in any other industry. And, you know, that's great. That's a big part of football. But, you know, you do sometimes need to just calm down, take a step back and look at it rationally in a human sense. And we all have our ambitions, you know, no matter where you are, if there's something that you consider to be a better opportunity, more money to work with better people, then you can't really begrudge him for taking it.
And a 6 month notice period is a long notice period.
Exactly.
As well.
I know a lot of people, you know, they'll say, oh, well, if I put myself in his position, I'd still play every game. I mean, look at Sanchez now. Even though the prospect of going to Man City, he'll still be playing tonight against Chelsea. And there's things, a couple of little things have soured it. Maybe it's the fact that he's, you know, he didn't make himself available. Was he injured or not? No. Well, it doesn't look like that way now. Then there's the whole with the piece that did with the Daily Mail, giving access to it. It just sours things, and I think that's. He's a favourite with all fans, and I don't think many up till the last few weeks would have begrudged them that move anyway.
You mentioned Sanchez there, and a major positive for Liverpool, because I think Liverpool are a team on the rise. I think compared to anyone else apart from maybe Man City, that they're looking, you know, mostly together and very much on the up. And when you talk about Sanchez, and we touched on Wenger earlier, Arsenal look like they might be losing their best player, Alexis Sanchez, for about 30-40 million euros or pounds or whatever it is. Ozil might be going for free, arguably their second best player, and you've got Liverpool selling their first, second, third best player for £130 million. So at the very least, you know, you can be more confident than Arsenal fans that the people running your club, in a business sense, are doing the right thing, and you know, success on the pitch is certainly aided by that.
Well, yeah, I think Arsene Wenger's become soft in his old age. I think the fact that Arsenal were never a club that they're in a great position where they can afford to do it and they can afford to lose the money, but the money that they could get last summer for the pair, you would have thought he would have just backed himself to be able to invest that. And maybe I've just corrected myself there by saying he's not soft. Maybe he just doesn't trust his own ability anymore to be able to replace some players, because for so many years, I mean, he wasn't scared of the likes of Vieira and people like that. He wasn't scared of just thinking, oh, well, you just can go, I'll replace you with somebody better, or maybe he's not better, but I'll replace you, no problem. And now, you see, with he's hung on to Per Mertesacker, which it must be a great person to have around the squad, great experience and great to have in the dressing room, but the fact that he's having to rely on him and he just can't anymore. So, like I said, maybe he just doesn't trust himself now.
All right, let's look forward to this weekend's Premier League action. I sound like some geezer on the TV. This weekend's Premier League action.
One day.
And the number 114, which is the number of league goals scored between Manchester City and Liverpool combined. Man City with 64 and Liverpool 50. Obviously, we've just been speaking about Liverpool and that attack. So they're facing each other. Is it going to be a goal fest, or is it going to be one of these situations where we build it up, we say, it's going to be 6-6, and then it's 0-0?
Well, I think it'll be a good game. I don't think it's going to be one of those games that we see every now and again, generally involving a Jose Mourinho side. Liverpool are a bit more adaptable than they used to be, and they can sit back a little bit. It's not just this crazy rock and roll high press all the time now that they've found a way to play on the counter and use the pace of Mane and Salah. And that's what you'd expect them to do here. Are they good enough to keep Man City at bay? Are they good enough at defending in a low block? Possibly not, and I think Man City will score goals. So then it's up to the individual class, really, and the counter-attacking of Liverpool. But for me, this is the game between the first and the second best teams in the league. I know that between Man U, Chelsea and Liverpool, points-wise, it's all pretty equal at the moment. But, you know, Liverpool, a relatively slow start, but they're 17 unbeaten in all competitions. Mm-hmm. They haven't lost since mid-October. They've not been doing that thing that we expect them to do, where they drop points against teams that they shouldn't do. I think they've lost twice, Man City and Spurs, so they're putting away the bad teams, which they didn't used to do. And I think, as I said, compared to Man U and to Chelsea, I think they're a better team, and I prefer watching them to both of those teams as well.
I think it's pretty. I've got here on my magical piece of paper that obviously I pretend is all my brain, but is actually a piece of paper. Pretty impressive, Liverpool, with the 50 goals this season, because other than Man City, who are on 64, the only other side to score 50-plus goals in the league this season in Europe is PSG, who, I mean, whenever I look, seem to be winning 6-1 against some part of France that I've not heard of. But that is an awful lot of goals. So if this isn't 6-6, like I said, I am going to be disappointed.
Yeah. Caveat to that is obviously that 22 games have been played in the Premier League. I think in La Liga it's only 18. So I'm sure after 22 games, Barcelona will be around that sort of mark. But yeah, I mean, they're elite numbers. They're around the top of the European leagues. And at home, they've only conceded 4 goals. So, you know, we talk about their attack all the time, but their defensive record at home is fantastic. And you know, they'll need to lean on that this weekend.
If you look at Liverpool as well, you know, what's their strength is it just breaking on sides at lightning speed. But if they get it's whether they get the chance to do that or not against Man City, because they're notoriously, if anybody tries to break on them, they just break it up with their tactical fouls. And if they can, I think if one advantage that they can get in this game, it might be through yellow cards and red cards. You know, if they are going to counter attack a lot and use that pace, it's the only way it's going to be stopped.
Do you think Guardiola is going to be looking at Virgil van Dijk with envy, shaking his fist at what could have been?
Oh, perhaps. But I think if he really wanted them, I think he probably would have gotten them. I mean, I know Jurgen Klopp might be a big draw for Van Dijk, and that might be the sounds that he makes, and because, well, he's ended up there. But like I said, if financially, he could have blown Liverpool out the water if he wanted to.
He's got a lot to prove, Van Dijk, because when you go through a transfer saga like that, and when you're clearly the one that everyone wants, you become almost this sort of mythical figure, you know, the best player in the world, the best defender in the world. And he's, you know, he's had a great start and he's clearly a brilliant player, but he hasn't played a huge amount of football this season. So he certainly has plenty to prove as well.
And judging by that goal on Friday, he could be the replacement for Coutinho. They never knew they had. Let's move on to I'm Embarrassed to Ask. I'm embarrassed.
embarrassed to ask?
All right then, lads. The FA have come out and said that they're going to apply to the Rooney rule when they look for the next England manager. Now, at risk of sounding like every football Twitter account, I'm assuming the Rooney rule isn't just someone who's going to underwhelm in a World Cup, because, you know, that's what we've been doing for years. David, what on earth is the Rooney rule?
Well, the Rooney rule, I think it was brought in American football and NFL in 2003 to give great opportunities to coaches, black and ethnic minority. It's worked, and I think that's the greatest thing. The argument of not having many black managers, or certainly not the equivalent of the equivalent of sort of an equation with the amount of black and ethnic minority footballers that are playing the Premier League now. I think it's up to 33% now in the Premier League. Yet across the leagues now, I think there's three managers in the whole of the Premier League Football League.
I've got some numbers to help you out there. So this is from an article on The Independent. The reality in 2018 is this: of the 482 leading coaching roles across clubs in England's top four divisions, only 22 belong to coaches of BAME backgrounds. So, and only four of them managers across the whole of the Football League. So as David says, it's undeniable that people from BAME backgrounds have been misrepresented throughout the history of football when it comes to post-playing career. And this is a way of redressing that balance, which needs to happen. It's a small step, because this isn't saying these managers are going to be given jobs. They're not going to be given roles or coaching roles, managerial roles, not by any means. This just means that more so than ever before, there will be opportunities which quite frankly haven't existed. And you know, among the many arguments against it, most of which I don't agree with, one seems to be that, well, if they were good enough, then they would have, then they, you know, then people wouldn't, you know, then surely that they wouldn't be discriminated against. And it doesn't need to necessarily be a conscious thing. I think it's part of the culture over the course of footballing history, and one of the problems is that when a group of people don't feel like they're going to get the opportunities, perhaps they're less inclined to spend their time doing coaching courses, to spend their time doing the badges, when they don't feel like the end result will be as favourable as someone else, non-BAME background. And as I said, it's not a big thing, this. It's an important step, I should say, but this is not going to, you know, this isn't positive discrimination. This isn't anything bad. This is a good step for English football, and it's needed.
If I was going to play devil's advocate, Pete, the easily outraged among the Twitter sphere would say, "Oh, what does this mean? Chris Hughton's getting an interview for the England job?" But I mean, that means nothing. It just means he's getting an interview. So it's not.
Yeah.
It seems to me like it's, like you say, just an encouraging small thing rather than any sort of big statement.
Yeah, but I mean, what it does, we talk about opportunity. Chris Hughton might be interviewed for the England job. He might get interviewed, and he might do a damn good interview, and he might put across ideas and perspectives that the people conducting interviews have never taken into consideration, or just a chance for him to sway them in his direction, and so that opportunity can turn into a job, and that's the most important thing.
But I don't think we should just be focusing on the England manager role here. The Rooney rule's been used in the EFL since the start of last year. I think this is across, again, not just managerial positions. That's sort of the headline, isn't it? Because it looks good, it leaps off the page. But this is across the FA, in all roles, in all coaching roles, all managerial roles within the FA, women's game, men's game, disability teams. This is across the FA. And I think the idea is that it'll slowly be rolled out across the Premier League as well eventually.
I mean, it's quite damning, really, that we can probably, between the three of us, we can probably name the managers and the prominent coaches in the division, in all the leagues. You look at people like Darren Moore at West Brom and Jason Newell at Charlton, Keith Curl at Carlisle. You know, it's
out of the very few coaches and managers of BAME backgrounds. QPR definitely sort of leading the way, it seems. They've got Les Ferdinand's their sporting director, and it's clearly something that they've taken upon themselves, and they're a sort of leading light for this. So, you know, big props, I suppose, to QPR, and hopefully many clubs will sort of follow their lead.
Yeah, I mean, there's been anecdotal sort of stories about, you know, I know Claude McAleely came out and said that that he hadn't found that a lot of his fellow black players had wanted to go into coaching. I certainly know that when I started to take my coaching badges, I think I can think of out of 50 names, there was probably two black players who were on those coaching courses. But is that because they think it's not, they won't have the opportunities, so it deters them? So if this makes sure that there's more applicants to coaching courses, and therefore more into the jobs and into football itself, then it's positive. And I know that it's not something that's just been ruled out now as well. I know across a lot of championship clubs, and my time at Barnsley, they had a policy the same that every job that was interviewed there, it's their academy had to include somebody from a black and ethnic minority background. So it's not just something that they've decided to do now. Clubs have been introducing it themselves as well.
Mm. And how long do you think it's going to be until it would be in the Premier League? Because it seems mad that it would be at the FA, you know, the national team, which I guess you put at the highest level. It's the EFL, which is every level underneath, and then Premier League haven't followed suit.
Oh, I mean, they've got to. It's only a matter of time, really. I mean, they shouldn't have to be pressured into it just because everyone else is doing it. It should be something that they're at the forefront of, and they shouldn't have waited until now. Like I said about, you know, we talked about opportunities before, about getting that chance of being interviewed for jobs. It's a fact that if people don't think they get the opportunities, but then they are given it, and the more interviews that they're given, it's an art in itself. You see so many managers now that maybe don't have a lot of substance to what they do, but they get jobs off because they're very impressive in interviews. And I think it's like any walk of life and any job. The more the more interviews you do, the better you get at it. You know what the people are looking for, and you become better at it. So that's a huge positive in this.
And also just on the Premier League, I think it's expected that they will adopt this. But it should be said that also from this article that I read, that they are playing a part outside of just this thing. They've been funding apprenticeships for up and coming BAME coaches in recent times as well. So it's not like they're ignoring this completely, but certainly could be doing more.
All right, then let's move on to the next section. Who's this fella?
Who's this fella?
Right then, lads. I think Robbie Savage, who was on commentary for the Nottingham Forest Arsenal game, might have fallen in love this weekend, because there was an 18-year-old lad up front who was bullying the Arsenal defenders, Ben Brereton. And we talked a little bit about Nottingham Forest earlier and their young players, but he was the man of the match and looked like something special. Now, he's been around a few teams, hasn't he? Or maybe did he leave an academy when he was 16 and got picked up by Forest?
Yeah, so I'm going to be a bit of an EFL bore, a bit of an EFL nerd, a bit of a hipster, however you want to say. But Robbie Savage is going to have to join a queue, of which I think I might be very near the front, to be honest. He burst onto the scene last season. He was released by Stoke, age 16, as you said, and Nottingham Forest picked him up, not to sort of name drop or whatever, but I went and interviewed him at the end of last season. He was the Championship Apprentice of the Year, and I helped to make the videos for the EFL Awards, and I went and did an interview with him. So I know a lot about Ben Brereton. He scored the winner against Aston Villa live on Sky. It was his first professional goal in one of his first appearances. And since then, they couldn't ignore him. They kept giving him chances, and he kept playing well. Now, this season, he's become a first team player at the age of 18. He is a striker and a goal scorer, and someone that can just terrorise centre backs if they don't have pace, as we saw on the weekend with Mertesacker and Holding. Has been shifted out wide a bit, which often happens with young players who maybe don't have the discipline to play a whole game through the middle. But you know, he's already got physical attributes that put him towards the top end of the game. His finishing is good. His instinct is good. He makes the right runs. He's been scoring goals for the England youth teams. And he's just a really exciting player. And you know, it's easy to look back and say to Stoke, well, what the hell were you doing? Mm. But from what I believe, he really has come on just unbelievably in the last sort of 18 months. And credit to Gary Brazil, who's the academy manager at Nottingham Forest, and Nottingham Forest for what they've done with him. But yeah, really exciting prospect.
Brilliant penalty as well. And he scored it with 1 foot. Who was it? Was the 2 foot penalty? Was that Kieran Dowell?
Dowell,
on loan from Everton.
Yeah.
Isn't he?
Yeah.
What you're seeing with the likes of these two players we mentioned, Kieran Dowell and Brereton, is the fact that they aren't your typical academy under 18, under 23 players. And so what you're seeing now, players who aren't in that mould, who do the old-fashioned things well, you look at Brereton, he uses his body so well. He's not, I mean, you look at him, for an 18-year-old, yeah, he's well-developed. Put him next to an average 18-year-old and he will look stronger. He probably is a little bit quicker. But nothing is exceptional in his physical attributes, but it's his willingness and his desire to... He wants to make forward runs. He wants to take people on. He wants to... It's a term I don't like using the word bully because it has such a negative sort of connotation, but he does that with defenders. He uses very well, and he uses it very cleverly as well. So if he gets 6 inches, a foot in front of somebody, he just leans across them and then it takes them out of the equation. He's not having a battle with them. And then they've got to watch themselves, because if they get too tight with them, then they'll bring him down. Mm. And same with Dowell as well. Like, you know, he does a lot of he works hard, breaks up play. He's still a good footballer, but he does the two of them do the side of the game that's not typical of the way the academy footballers are produced these days. Mm.
And there was a documentary in the week, was it No Hunger in Paradise? I think that was doing a lot of obviously talks about the youth academies and the chances players get. And are they in the best place for them in the Championship at that age, getting games? Because obviously that was a high profile game, and they scored against Arsenal and probably heaped value onto themselves, which, you know, what would it be in January? It wouldn't be out of, you know, it wouldn't be completely abnormal to see a Premier League club put in a bid for him now. Mm. Are they better off just staying there, racking up minutes for another year and a half? Or when you see that potential, should they take a jump to the Premier League?
Well, Priestley might be better placed to comment on it, because he's been part of clubs and he's probably seen at a couple of different levels how academy players develop and what's best for them. But, you know, as someone that follows the Football League, there are multiple examples of players getting minutes in the Football League that they wouldn't get in the Premier League and naturally developing a little bit quicker. It's tough, because then you say, well, they deserve their chance in the Premier League. If you go too early, though, aged 18, 17, 18, 19, quite often you then suffer from those same lost years, you know, between 18 and 21, 22, that you see in Premier League academy players. So it's a really, really tough one. You can't just say to someone, stay at a lower level for 3 years just to play, because it seems counterintuitive. Yeah. But of course, it's easy to say, you know, that does help them develop as a player, but there's a lot of other things at play, isn't there? It's not just, you know, that's not the only thing that you've got to think about.
Yeah, if you plan your career correctly and everything goes to plan, and maybe the best way of doing it would probably be to start off at a bigger club, so you have the best education. That's the most important thing, is to have a good football and education. So you see a lot of players, I don't know, some like a lot of players that's leave Manchester United at a young age. There's somebody like Danny Drinkwater. So you go there, you get your education, then you go down to the Championship, you play your games there, and then you use that as a springboard to get back up again. Now, of course, it doesn't happen all the time, and things don't go to plan like that. But ideally, that's what you want to do, because I know that I always equate it to your driving test and learn to drive, that you don't really learn how to drive. Maybe I'm phrasing this wrong, but you learn more after you've passed your test and you're in the car by yourself and gain more experience. So that's you going to a club and playing a lot of games. And the earlier you can do that, the better, because the more you get stuck in this system of playing nice football and you're unchallenged mentally as much as anything, then you're going to regress, and the people who are playing the games are going to just bypass you. I mean, you see now that there's a hell of a lot of players now coming from conference clubs who have been released as kids between 16 and 18, going to conference clubs, going to League Two clubs, playing a lot of games and then coming back again. And they're bypassing all these players who have stayed at clubs 5-6 years and still in the under 23 sides, because they're gaining that experience. It's crucial to your development, and you don't want to stagnate too long. And it's great that Forest are doing this and they're sticking the kids in there as early as they are.
Mm. I don't want to dwell on that too long because we're running quite long. But is there a case? I mean, Chelsea are a bit of a strange situation because basically won't give youth a chance, and I think that's fairly well. It's a accepted, universally held opinion. Yeah. Is there a case that if a player is going to be high class Premier League quality, and this is something that they were saying in the documentary the other night, you have to be good enough to get in the first team of the top 8 teams in the Premier League, otherwise you're not going to play regularly in the Premier League?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's so many.
I know that kind of sounds stupid, but I mean, like for West Ham, say, who are 15th, if a youth player was to get in and play regularly in that West Ham team, he would have to be of the quality to be getting in a top 6 team every week. Otherwise, every mistake is scrutinised tenfold.
Well, yeah, and so many parts to this, but another big part, obviously, is the sacking culture with managers these days. Your job security relies on you getting results in the here and now. And apart from the incredibly few clubs that appear to be developing a system that thinks long term, that tries to develop players because they recognise that that's a good way of adding to the squad and helping the team, and therefore give managers a little bit more leash, maybe even make it part of their job remit to play some younger players. Other than those clubs, the reality is in the Premier League, you lose your job within, you know, a click of your fingers, and you know, you probably go to sleep at night thinking, I might give that kid a chance in that game because he looks like a talent, I'd like to help him develop. By the time you wake up in the morning in a cold sweat, you realise that, you know, you don't know you can trust him. And that's where another part of the problem lies.
Only the top managers who can have a certain amount of security. You know, you look at Klopp. Klopp was never going to be, no matter how things went in the beginning, Klopp was never going to be in danger of losing his job. So it was always, he did some great PR when he first went to the club. I think the first morning he took over, he was at an under-18s or under-23 game watching them. And it's great for clubs that the manager take that involvement from the very base all the way up. But I think it's like I just said, so difficult for them to be able to think beyond sort of a month or two in advance, really, because they have to make sure that first and foremost they stay in the job. Then if they get the chance to develop players and be there long enough to develop players. But I mean, look at Mark Hughes. He's been there, was it there 4.5 years? I mean, that's an eternity, really. Especially for a sort of club that's not quite sort of not successful. Clubs get at a certain stage and a certain level and plateau, and people want change, and so there's always a big roundabout. But I think that with younger players, it's very rare that they're given the chance as well either. So someone like Jesse Lingard, no, he's probably a player that's many clubs they would probably say, well, you know, he's not a regular, so it's probably time he moved on, and he'd be advised to move on. When he you've got to give him credit because he stuck at it as well. All right, it's very difficult to leave a club like Manchester United. There's a lot of players who, you know, who find it difficult, especially when they move. And if you're the biggest club in the world, why would you want to move?
Yeah.
And you're still getting game time. But I mean, was he 24 now?
Yeah.
And all the work that's been put into him, is coming to fruition now. But it's clubs, some clubs, most clubs don't have that the luxury of being able to have that time to develop players.
Okay, let's move on to the final section of today's podcast, and that is Stats Showdown.
Stats Showdown.
Okay, I can see you both itching with your fingers on the stat trigger. Ali, eager to avenge a Stats Showdown loss in your last appearance. I'll come to you first. The best 2 out of 3 with a couple of impressed me stats that I can go up to someone at the bar and say, you heard this? It's going to blow your mind.
Yeah. So generally in the Premier League this season, teams who have sat their managers have done pretty well. Leicester, Palace, West Ham, Everton, all have improved since getting a new man in. Alan Pardew arrived at West Brom saying that he was going to free up West Brom by adding flair and excitement. Since he took charge, 8 games, 4 goals in 8 games. They've not been freed up. One of them was that penalty against Arsenal. That's a lower rate than how they were scoring under Tony Pulis.
Pardiola, the fraud.
Maybe that's his problem. Maybe it's because he's had more of an effect on West Brom than he did on West Brom. Maybe that's his problem. Well, I've got one. I was at Spurs Wimbledon game at the weekend, and even with the aid of a slight deflection, Jan Vertonghen scored a goal. Now, I've always had Jan Vertonghen down as a
buccaneering centre back.
Yeah, someone who would always get you a goal. Now, he scored for the first time in 1,536 days.
It's like five years, isn't it? 4 or 5
Three.
Years?
3.5 years, I reckon.
I can't count, can I?
I'm quite glad about, because I'm not a big fan of his Superman celebration. Gets my nerves a little bit. That
it was
one.
A screamer as well, wasn't it? Didn't he?
Yeah, but it just took a deflection off on the defender's hands that just lifted in the top corner, made it look a bit more impressive, I think. But it was a hell of a strike, yeah.
He gets like 3 assists, 4 assists a year as well, doesn't he?
Actually, his last goal was October 2013.
Oof.
Against Sheriff Tiraspol. Don't ask me where that is.
Yes, isn't it? Yeah. You've shocked me, David. I'm going to give you the first one there. I just assumed he was a swashbuckling, goal-scoring, assist-getting centre-back.
Mm.
I was wrong. Ali, you're 1-0 down. David, you can go 2-0 up and kill him dead before he's even had a chance to reply.
Well, I'm going to go... The stat I'm going to go for and the number I'm going for is 3. And I'll give you a guess. What could this be? 3.
Points that Swansea are going to get in the rest of the season?
No. It is the number of operations that Antonio Conte has had on his hair transplants. It's topical, you know. Jose Mourinho's had a bit of a go at his hair in the past as well, so...
I don't want to get a tweet from Antonio Conte saying David Priest is a little man now.
Couldn't he have got like a slightly cooler style?
Yeah,
I mean,
thinning.
If they can do anything, which clearly they can, it's very impressive. But like, couldn't he have? Did he have a pick of any hairstyle and went for that?
Well, it was either that or Wayne Rooney, so I know which one I go for.
That's a fair point.
Or David Silva's, which appears to just have a line going across it.
Yeah, remarkable. Mm. Mine is. Kicking Arsenal while they're down.
Just, people have been doing it for 10 years.
And also a little nod to Preece's former career. Arsenal have conceded each of their last 23 penalties faced in the Premier League, stretching back to August 2013. When your team gives away a penalty and you're like, and then it's saved. Only second only to a goal, right?
Yeah.
They haven't felt that feeling. For 23 penalties, Pedacek rooted.
And that's going back 4 years as well.
Mm. I'm
going to
do my countdown thing here. You know, on countdown where they show that they've got the same words and then they've got to prove to each other.
Yeah, I thought you might, to be honest.
You're stalling my stat.
I thought you might. We're both very good at researching. We know the right places to look.
Are you frantically finding a third one now?
I'm going to have to now, yeah.
Do you know what? I played that one because I thought Preece might have it.
So you played that one because you're a plagiarist. All right. Okay, just because you've stunned David and is stunned David where he is, where he stands, whatever I'm trying to say, Ali, you're levelling that one up.
Thank
and
you.
I mean, head oos, as much as I enjoyed it, not strictly speaking.
Well, it was either that or I was trying to guess how many players and managers had hair transplants in the Premier League. I'd got Rooney, Klopp, Conte, Fabregas and Eriksen.
Bilic,
yeah, well, he's not at the moment.
Course,
I would have put Bilic in. So if there's any, if anybody does know anybody's had a hair transplant, and if anybody's got a number for any surgeons, I'd be quite happy with this.
All right, Ali, now's your chance. It's all even. Are you going to score the winner, the late winner with your hand like Glenn Murray, with no VAR to refer to?
It's astonishing the amount of times that the stats showdown is 1-1 going into the last stat, isn't it?
It's almost like... It's an unwritten narrative.
It's a very competitive competition, I think that's fair to say, and it says a lot about the quality of guests. Here's mine, and it's related to the weekend's fixtures, which is very important. What's the Spanish... Any of you speak Spanish? What's the Spanish for bogey team?
¿Dónde?
Barcelona and Real Sociedad. Barcelona haven't won against Real Sociedad in the league since 2007, that's 10 years without a win at Anoeta. How many times have they beaten Real Madrid at the Bernabeu in the league in the same period? 7. Since beating Real Sociedad away, they've beaten Real Madrid away 7 times. Truly, El Equipo del Bogey.
So you knew what it was?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, just seeing if you did.
You spun us a yarn. All right. David, what's your El Stato del Bogey?
Well, we were talking about sort of youth development earlier on, and across the six youth sides from England's under 16s up to 21s, there's been a rundown of all the breakdown of how many players come from each club. So, top of this. Of the list is Chelsea with 20 players. Manchester City had 18 players involved in all the England sides this summer. Arsenal 16, Tottenham 11. Can you tell me with... Everton 7. And outside that, can you tell me who has had the most players involved?
I'm just going to pull someone completely random out of the bag, see? What about, let's go for QPR.
I'm going to guess Fulham.
It's actually Nottingham Forest.
Ah.
With 6, which is 3 more than Manchester United had.
Really?
Across the 6 sides from under 16 and under 21.
United only had 3?
Only had 3 in all.
Oof. Ali's...
It's not bad for... It wasn't bad for just pulling one out of the hat.
No.
Yeah, pretty good that.
Ali, you're sweating. I can see it from here. Who am I gonna hand the L to? Oh, Ali looks so downbeat. I've got too much... I'm too kind of person.
Don't pity him!
In a way, it's almost worse if you've got a pity. In fact, no, forget it. You don't get the pity win. David, you win. David, you win.
Oh, no.
Losing streak of 2 in a row for Ali. David, if people want to find you on the internet, where can they get you?
They can get me at DavidPriest12.
And Ali, yourself?
Yeah, I'm at the Makalele role.
And you can find me at @RobArmstrong_WH. And of course, you can find this podcast on Deezer, where you can also find lots more great podcasts, live Premier League commentary and football playlists. Download the Deezer app or go to www.deezer.com, the website. Remember those, Ali? Remember websites? And you'll see us there on the website or the app next week on Defending in Numbers.
Defending in Numbers is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.